Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to B-O-L-L and branch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome into the Odds and Audibles podcast. I'm Matt Bream, Eric Scopel on the show as always. And it's our once a week basketball edition only of the podcast. We're going to break down both the men and the women's programs, what's happened over the past week. A lot to go over. We're going to start with the women because I feel like, Eric, this is probably a... not necessarily a surprise, but hey, it's big news. They've lost a game this year now. 27 game win streak has been snapped.
Correct.
For the Oregon women's basketball program. They split at home in games against USC and at the time, number 11 UCLA. And you were wondering, right? Like, when would Oregon lose? I think everyone kind of expected, hey, they were going to lose, probably going to lose a couple times because the league is really good.
Yeah.
This is such a young team, so many newcomers, COVID-19. It's set up for some losses. And we get dealt a unbelievable back and forth game, 73-71 UCLA. You were there to cover it. Before we break down the game itself, before we break down USC, what was the mood? What was the messaging that we got from a team that, quite honestly, it's been a very long time since they've lost a basketball game?
Well, you mentioned 27 straight games they had won, and then it dates all the way back to February of 2019, almost two full years since they'd lost at home. And it was actually to UCLA in that instance as well. I think... you know, we spoke with Coach Graves. We spoke with Aaron Boley afterwards. I think both of them, and those are obviously two, you know, Graves is a head coach. He's been through this a lot. He's experienced a lot of loss. Aaron Boley, this is her senior season. Obviously, she's hasn't lost a ton of games because she's played on some Oregon teams that simply just don't lose very often. But I think it was pretty measured. And I think the most emotion, you know, that I saw afterwards was it looked like Niara Sabali, who this is her first loss as a collegiate player, and a couple of the freshmen really were upset after the game, in part because I think they just felt like they were so close to winning this game. And we'll talk about why in a second here, just a lot of opportunities. And they just couldn't get over the hump against a really good UCLA team. We need to give them a lot of credit too. This is not a game where Oregon gave it away. This is a game where UCLA snatched it and they played fantastic basketball. But I think you look at this and go, you're right. Eventually, Oregon was going to lose a game, and this was far and away the best team Oregon had played on its schedule yet. I know Oregon State was ranked at the time. I think the Beavers are really on a down year this year, and they are not. Traditionally, they've been a conference championship caliber team in the Pac-12, or right on the cusp of that, at least during Oregon's run. And before that, Oregon State was the better team in the state by a mile, and they dominated the series. They're not that good, and Oregon beat them by 20 points, and it was kind of like, okay, wow, maybe they're just going to dominate everybody. But UCLA is a different animal, and they provided some really tough matchups for Oregon. And I kind of went into this game, especially with a couple of injury notes that we'll get to as well here, with Sedona Prince and Taylor Chavez, two starters or borderline starters, two really key players not available, that this was going to be a tough one. And to UCLA's credit, I thought they played about as well as they could. And to Oregon's credit, and maybe we can just jump into this in a second here, of like they battled and fought every single possession down the stretch to try to win this game. And with a young team, they were eventually going to meet a game where they just couldn't pull it out. And they got there against, again, a Bruin team that has, I think, a top two or three WNBA draft pick in Mikayla Anyanwary. And Charisma Osborne's a sophomore, but eventually she's going to be a top WNBA draft pick, a really talented team. And Oregon finally met a team that was about as talented as they were, and they just couldn't get it done down the stretch. But it was a really, really well-played game. I think that part has to be said. This was not Oregon's true freshman and this young team kind of finally imploded. It was Oregon played, I thought, pretty darn good down the stretch for most part, and just couldn't quite get enough down, you know, just couldn't quite do enough to win this game.
Yeah, UCLA led this one 31 minutes and 44 seconds. Oregon had the lead just for 5 minutes and 33 seconds. So goes along of lines of what you were talking about. Oregon kept having to fight back to get back into this game. 9 lead changes, 4 times the score was tied. Largest lead by UCLA was 11, which came with 8 minutes to go in the third quarter. Largest lead by Oregon was 3, which was that came just crazily enough a couple of minutes later, 6 minutes and 39 seconds to go in that in the second quarter is when Oregon had their largest lead of this game. You mentioned it. No Taylor Chavez, no Sedona Prince. Either both of those players play, is this a different outcome?
Here's what I'll say is Mikayla Anyanwary scored 33 points in this game. Charisma Osborne scored 22. 55 of the 73 points by UCLA were scored by two players. A ton of what both of those players, well, especially Anyanwary, a ton of what she does is in the paint. And Oregon just did not have a player capable of really contesting shots. And they tried a lot of different things. And, you know, you notice if you look at the box score, Aaron Boldy plays 23 minutes, but barely played in the second half. And that was because Oregon went with some younger players, Angela Dugalich in particular, to match up with her, because they just, you know, it was a deal where Boldy just couldn't really match her athletically. And Anyanwary kind of ate her up. And I think, you know, if you had a Sedona Prince available to check a Lauren Miller, who's UCLA's center, and she's a big kind of broad-shouldered player, that was where Nayara Sabali focused her attention. If you could have had Nayara Sabali kind of check Anyanwary the whole game and had Sedona Prince at least kind of factoring into things against Lauren Miller, that might have changed things a little bit. I think Sabali at least would have been able to, you know, kind of keep her away from the rim a little bit more. Obviously, there's a challenge there with the foot quickness with Anyanwary, who's just an incredible athlete. So I think that's where it changes. And then with Taylor Chavez, she probably plays quite a bit defending Osborne, who again had 22 points as a point guard for the Bruins. She hit 5 threes. I think offensively, I don't know how much it would have changed things. I mean, obviously, both those players are capable offensive players. That really wasn't where I saw the issues. I thought it was defensive. They just had really no answer for either of UCLA's big two. And it really bit them. And if you could have found a way to incorporate, I think you could have found certainly, not an if, it's a you certainly could have found a way to incorporate Taylor Chavez against Osborne, and certainly could have found a way to at least switch up some stuff around the basket against Anyanwary if you had Sedona Prince available. Do they think they win this game if they have one or both of them? Maybe. I think they very well could have won this game without them, though, too. I mean, there were some opportunities down the stretch of this game where, I'll just dive into it, where like Oregon had 3 possessions in the final 40 seconds of the game to score a basket and tie it, or to hit a 3 and go ahead. And they missed a 3 by Angela Dugalich to try to go ahead. And then the next 2 possessions, they didn't even get a shot off. And that was where you saw some of this youth, some of this inexperience in big moments. Taylor Mikesell, who's an experienced veteran player from Maryland previously, called for a travel. You go back and watch it. I think she had a couple places to go with the ball that would have resulted in maybe a basket or at least a good look. And then Tahina Paopao drives to the rim and gets caught up with a jump ball, basically as the clock expires. That could have been a foul from my perspective, from my vantage point. Like, she kind of got bear hugged. But at the same time, credit to UCLA for making the big plays. But Oregon, just their inability to get a shot up at the end there kind of bit them more than anything else. And again, this is a, you know, if you want to go glass half full, silver linings thing of, this is a young team that hadn't lost before. They're about to face an incredible gauntlet of teams these upcoming weekends here. They're going to face Stanford on Friday. The next week, they'll face Arizona, who's number 7 in the country. The weekend after that, this game got overlooked for a while. But Washington State, if they continue to win games like it looks like they might, they could be ranked by the time they come to Eugene at the end of this month. So the schedule here is pretty daunting coming forward here. And Oregon needed to battle test it. And I know they lost this game, but you can kind of go, again, kind of silver lining is, hey, they've now played 2 games against UCLA and Washington State. They won one of them that were really close games. They lost the other. And I think you learn a little bit of something from each of those experiences, especially with a team that, let's be real here, like basically none of these players on this entire team that were playing in these games have been in these moments besides Aaron Boldy, Jazz Shelley, Taylor Chavez, and Lydia Giomi. I guess you can say Taylor Mikesell, but just not at Oregon. This is a group that needed some kind of experience in these moments. They got there. They didn't win this one, but I think there's a potential that this could help them going forward.
And that was going to be kind of the next discussion point here is, what's the fallout from this? I mean, obviously it's one game. You don't want to make too much of 27 game season, or is it 24 game season?
It'll be 24 regular season plus whatever's after.
Right. So 20, you don't want to make one loss out of a 24 game regular season become this huge deal. And they lost by two. We should all, I mean, it's not like they were blown out. I don't think you walk out of this game thinking, oh my God, there's a whole bunch of problems. But ramifications, they now sit behind a couple people in the Pac-12 standings. Is it something that, hey, it's going to work itself out? As long as Oregon doesn't lose three or four more times the rest of the year, they can get in. They will have that opportunity to win the league. Or are they in a spot where the league is so competitive that, hey, you know what? You just lost a game, albeit to a, you know, one of the top teams in the conference. You can't lose a couple more of these because if you do, you might fall behind.
There's a chance Stanford is going to be just unbeatable. And I say that because they just played Arizona, who's ranked seventh nationally, and they beat them by 27 points on the Wildcats home court. So this game on Friday is, to me, going to be a big barometer of like, okay, if Oregon can go in and challenge Stanford and maybe steal a game against the Cardinal, then it's like, okay, this is wide open. If they go out and they get blasted pretty good, to me at that point, because Stanford's already also beaten UCLA, it becomes Stanford might just win this thing kind of running away. And now it's a battle for second. And a battle for second in this Pac-12 conference is really crazy. It could still be a one or a two seed is the crazy thing. Like probably a two seed, but like, you know, even if they don't win the conference this year, and obviously that's the goal after having dominated this conference the last handful of years or so. That's what everybody wants is the fourth consecutive. I don't think finishing second in a conference that has a Stanford team who right now is the front runner to win the national championship, given in a year where there's probably not quite as clear top end. I know Kelly Graves said he thinks Stanford is a clear cut number one, but you of course are going to say that 5 days before playing that team, you're not going to try to diminish what they are. But like, I think Oregon goes into this game with Stanford and like this game with the Cardinal is could not be any bigger, because if Oregon can go in and if they can win the game, suddenly the thing opens right back up. It's completely wide open again. But if they, even if it's a close loss, I still go, okay, well, maybe that gives you a glimmer of hope that Oregon can kind of run the table after that, can win the return game against Stanford at Matthew Knight Arena. That is mid-February, February 15th. They can win that game. Everything kind of looks, you know, you get a chance to get back into it. But if they lose the game decisively and it looks like Stanford's just on a different class, which is, I'd say, possible, but probably not probable. You know, I don't think they're going to get blown out, but let's say they do. Then you kind of come to a spot of, okay, Pac-12 conference championships probably not going to happen this year unless Stanford just completely implodes, which I think is unlikely given who their head coach is. Terry Vanderveer's are one of the best coaches in the history of the sport for women's basketball. Then it becomes, okay, what let's kind of reassess our goals and focus here, and let's just try to win as many games as possible. And if we go 18-4 or 17-5 in the Pac-12, which has, again, like five teams that are right around the top 10. I should say four teams right around the top 10. A Washington State team, which seems like it's kind of on the rise as well. And suddenly it becomes, okay, well, they didn't finish with a conference win, championship, I should say, but they're still going to get a really respectable seed going in the NCAA tournament, and you just see what you can do, and it's kind of with house money at that point.
Status of Sedona Prince and Taylor Chavez. I feel like those two players being unavailable is a bigger concern, bigger unknown, whatever you wanted to use to describe it, than a 2-point home loss to UCLA.
I
look at this team and think Taylor Chavez, well, she's maybe not your number one, number two, or number three guard. She is one of your experienced players within this system. Sedona Prince, while she wasn't eligible last season, she had a whole year of practicing with Kelly Graves' system. And in a year in which there isn't a ton of practice leading up to the season, and because of COVID-19, the offseason workouts were severely changed and impacted because of COVID-19. And then on top of that, so many new faces. You needed to have kind of these culture players that could hammer home the team when they're not practicing well, hammer home in a clutch moment, in a timeout, in a critical game like this. Hey, we got this. Remember, we do this in practice because we do 1, 2, and 3. It's the same thing now on the court. That while talent overrides everything, experience within a system is pretty close to talent as well. Like, I'll always pick the most talented players over the over experienced players who are far, who are far inferior of talent. But at some point, you need to have these players in your system that know what they're doing and have gone through the battles of a season. And so I almost kind of wonder, like, right now, Taylor Chavez and Sedona Prince's availability are bigger concerns in my eyes.
Yeah, so here's what we know. Taylor Chavez is back in Arizona dealing with a family emergency. She was not available for either the USC or the UCLA game. I do know it's a three-day window to get players back. So for Taylor Chavez to play against Stanford on Friday, and of course the question here is, could she in theory be getting, and this is something that somebody I spoke with wasn't sure on, could she in theory be getting tested while in Arizona, and when she does return, have been tested continuously so that she can almost like meet the team at Stanford. There's no clarity on if that's a possibility, but let's just say that's not. She needs to be back in Eugene on Tuesday to then be available to play on Friday. And I don't know where her whereabouts are right now. We're recording this also on a Monday, so maybe we'll have some more details come out and this will be kind of a moot point. My guess is she's not available against Stanford. As far as Sedona Prince, it's pretty up in the air. My understanding from people I've talked to sounds like it's deal where if this was the NCAA tournament, she might be able to give them some minutes, but she's really struggling with this ankle injury. She's having a hard time walking, it's just a pain issue right now. It's pain management. So I think, and the suggestion I got is it's probably not against Stanford. It might be the following weekend in Tucson against the Arizona, and then back, and then a couple of days later in Tempe against Arizona State that we see her next. So I'm kind of guessing here. And again, we'll talk to Kelly Graves probably Wednesday or Thursday. I don't have exactly when yet. And we'll probably have more clarity at that point. My guess is we don't see either of them against Stanford. Or if we do, it's Sedona Prince in a pretty limited capacity. Like maybe she can play 8 to 10 minutes for them, which, you know, it's really a bummer. I feel, you know, this is, it, you feel for her now because this is her third year of college basketball and have missed her first year. She's hardly played. I mean, and for a player that Kelly Graves says has a chance to be the number one overall draft pick in the WNBA, has a chance to be a Pac-12 conference player of the year, compares her to Nikola Jokic, one of the best players in the NBA, of like someone with all of these accolades and potential. It's really devastating to have someone like that just unable to go so far through her career. I mean, she played two games healthy to start the season, suffered the ankle injury against Colorado, and has basically been playing spot minutes here and there until the last little bit where she hasn't played against the LA schools. So it remains to be seen with her, but my guess here is you're going to go into this weekend and the Bay Area without either player. And that really puts a lot of pressure on, again, especially in the front court, because I think the back court, they have the depth, but the front court, that puts a lot of pressure on Nyara Sabali, Aaron Boley, Kylie Watson, Angela Dugalic, and Lydia Giomi to kind of carry the brunt of this. And the reality is only Nyara Sabali, Aaron Boley, and Angela Dugalic have really shown they can hang with this caliber of a player. And it's going to be a tall task to ask against a Stanford team that's really big and really talented. It really is. This is not a great matchup right now, in my mind.
Okay. Oregon plays at Stanford Friday night. That game is on the Pac-12 networks. Really surprised that's not an ESPN game.
Same. Frustrated, actually. Come on, get that one on the bigger network. What are we doing? This is number one against number 11.
That's a marquee game that, I mean, ESPN went all in last year on women's basketball, not just at Oregon, not just in the Pac-12, just across the board. We had marquee games. Really surprised. Like, it wouldn't have surprised me in the slightest if we got a little schedule alteration and Oregon and Stanford are playing Thursday night at like the 6 or 7 p.m. game on ESPN. We see that from time to time. Monday too. Like, it wouldn't have surprised me if Cal game came first and Oregon got an extra day to play Stanford on a Monday, Monday. We see that sometimes. So one, really surprised that's on the Pac-12 network, 6 p.m. game. Eric will have coverage there. Cal is on Sunday at 1 p.m. That game is also on the Pac-12 networks. And then, like Eric already said, they then go to Arizona and Arizona State the following weeks, January 14th and January 17th. Big picture wise, Eric, what are you expecting out of this team? What are you looking for? What are the concerns you have over the next 1 to 2 weeks of this team, for this team?
Yeah, so they play two top 10 teams over the next, about 10 days, Stanford and Arizona. A, you can't get blown out by either of them. That's going to really hurt this team's confidence. I think if you can split those games, that is a huge win. I don't expect they're going to sweep these two teams. If they sweep these two teams, our conversation shifts and you go, not only can they win the conference championship, maybe this is like a dark horse national championship contender. And that's probably getting ahead a little bit because there's a lot of schedules to be played. But if they go beat Stanford and Arizona on the road, Oregon's going to be like a top three team nationally. And everyone's going to kind of go, wow, they have one loss to a really good UCLA team at home. And they've now beaten two of the top seven teams nationally, along with a big win over, again, I think a Washington State team, which is sneaky. Like, go look at their record and the teams they've beaten. They've been sneakily kind of just humming along there. Their only loss is to Oregon. I think suddenly that's a huge change there. But like, I think these two, you know, and you have to include the Cal game, which Cal's pretty bad. I think that's the game they'll win. But the sneaky one on the back end here is Arizona State. And I say that because Sun Devils always play the Ducks tough. Their last loss before this one was to Arizona State last year in Tempe. And the Sun Devils aren't what they've been in the past. They lost a ton of players from last year's team. But that is a really tenacious team. They play really hard. Their coach is a bulldog. She will battle with the officials. She will get the call she wants down the stretch of games if it's close. That's the one you kind of have to keep an eye on. So like I think best case scenario from my perspective is Oregon wins 3 out of 4 in this next two-week stretch, I should say, comes out of that. And then it kind of lets up a little bit for 2 weeks because you have Washington State, who, again, I think is tough, but that's at home. Washington, Utah, Colorado, those teams aren't very good. And then Arizona State at home. And that's right there. It's like a 5-game stretch where you probably should win out. And then after that, it's another huge, huge stretch of games where you go Arizona, Cal, Stanford, UCLA, 4 in a row there, where that's, again, the lot's going to change between now and early February. But this season's kind of broke up into those stretches now where you've got this 4-game stretch, which is really tough, followed by, I think, 5 very winnable games and then 4 really tough games after that. So you win, if you go 3 out of 4 here, you could start a lot of momentum going into the that middle portion of the schedule, like I mentioned, where you play 5, I think, very winnable games.
Seems like 2-2 is probably the most likely scenario. 3-1 is kind of your ideal outcome. 4-0 is probably too wishful thinking, but maybe possible. And then 1-3 or 0-4 sweep or the other direction are kind of your worst case scenarios. Would you be more shocked if they were swept or went they're not going to get swept. They'll be one of these.
They won't lose to Cal.
So if they go 1-3, how big of a shock is that to you?
Pretty big. I think pretty big. I think there's too much pride and talent on this team for that to happen. But like, you know, you could see it snowball here. Like, you lose to Stanford, and like the worst case scenario is probably this. You lose to Stanford in a game where you get blown out. You then beat Cal because Cal's not very good, and maybe it's closer than you expect. You then lose to Arizona, and you're just kind of depleted because the conference championship picture is completely out the window. You know you're going to drop. You've now kind of been, I don't want to say exposed, but you've lost a couple tough games. And then you go to an Arizona State place, which is not quite Boulder, Colorado for the men, but it's been just a house of horrors down there. It's a tough place to win for Oregon, basically in every sport you think about the last couple of years.
Pretty much.
You know, and then you just drop that game. And suddenly you look up and you go, holy cow, we were 6-0 in the Pac-12, or 7-0, sorry, in the Pac-12. So 6-0, my bad. In the Pac-12, and now you look up and you go, wow, now we're 7-4. What happened? So I don't think that's going to happen. My guess is they're going to win 2 of these games. And my hunch is probably they'll win 3, but we'll know a lot more on Friday. Like, Friday's game is going to be very, very instructive. Whenever you go against the number one team in the country in any sport, you're going to learn a lot, but especially when it's really your first, I know it's not, I keep wanting to say road atmosphere because it's not though, because it's weird this year because of COVID, but like your first really marquee team away from home. Like, I think that's going to be very instructive just to see kind of how they respond, especially about 5 days after the first loss in, gosh, almost a full calendar year. You're going to learn a lot on Friday against Stanford. We'll have full coverage of that And again, we'll have more podcasts following next weekend, recapping what could be a monumental win or could be a tough loss, and then heading into another tough weekend against the Arizona schools.
Real quick before we take a break, we'll end it on this. The first edition of the net rankings were released. And this is, if you're unfamiliar with the new stuff, what net is, it's the replacement for the RPI, which the NCAA committee will be using to help seed teams for the upcoming NCAA tournament. To give you an idea of how good the Pac-12 is from a women's standpoint, 9 of their 12 teams are ranked in the top 100. 9. Oregon State could be, you know, if they just get like 1 or 2 wins without a loss, they could pop into that top 100 because they're at 115. But nonetheless, Oregon has 9 teams in that top 100. And if you want to go just, you know, even further down the list and just pare it down to the top 25, the Pac-12 has 3 teams in the top 25. They've got 4 teams in the top 50. Really impressive from a league standpoint. And Eric, this caught me by surprise a little bit. And I think it probably caught you by a surprise. Your thoughts on Oregon being 4th. Stanford being 1, UConn 2, Baylor 3, Oregon 4.
Actually, I see 4 teams in the Pac-12 in the top 25, 5 in the top 50.
Sorry.
To your point, surprised that they're ranked there or that they're placed there, in part because I go, the best win they've had is Washington State. And Washington State's 55, kind of a fringe top fit. I think Washington State's actually really good. Like having watched them play, like they're that's not a joke team. They didn't play anybody. Their record isn't, you know, descriptive of what they are. Like, I think that Washington State team is going to be trouble in the Pac-12 for a lot of teams, and it's probably going to finish with like 13 to 15 wins in the conference, which is a crazy number for a program that's just been terrible for a while and a program that lost most of its good players. But like, I was surprised with that spot. And like Oregon, if they stay again, that's where like if they beat Stanford. And let's say, like, best case scenario here, Oregon legitimately can be in that conversation for a number one seed. I mean, right now they're like lined up there, but they've got a tough schedule going ahead. I really think it's going to take kind of an implosion for Oregon to fall out of the top 4 seeds in the tournament. Like, I really think they're going to be in that realm here, unless they drop a bunch of games and they lose games outside of this other elite group. Because Oregon is at 4, Stanford, you said, is at 1. You've got UCLA at 11. You've got Arizona all the way down at 21, and then you go Washington State at 48. Washington State's in the top 50. Washington at 55, Southern California at 60, Colorado 71, Arizona State 83, and then down to, you said, Oregon State down at 115. Like, Oregon, if they don't lose, as long as they don't lose any games outside of teams within the top 50, let's include Washington State there, like, I think they're going to be a top 4 seed in the tournament, and that sets you up for a deep run. And again, this is a team which I really feel like, and again, you see this obviously with Dane Altman, but I think you've seen it with Kelly Graves. They start to get better at the end of the season. And with a team that's made up of so many young, inexperienced players, like, I think the optimism has to be, hey, you get to March when the tournament starts and you're a good seed, you could be a team that kind of sneaks up on some people and makes some noise, because the upside is really, really high, especially assuming you get a fully healthy Sedona Prince at some point this season and everybody else stays healthy.
We're going to follow this all through the season for college basketball on the women's side. Interesting numbers early on. Will be interesting to see how the net changes over the next couple of weeks and what improvements the women make as well. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back here on the Odds and Audibles podcast, we are going to dive into the men's side of college basketball. Coming up next here on the Odds and Audibles podcast.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right, welcome back to the Autzen Audibles podcast. I'm Matt Prehm, Eric Scopel on the show as always. And real quick, before we dive into the men's side here, I want to remind you guys two things. One, this is a free thing to do. It helps us immensely. Go and give us a review, whether it's on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, whatever platform you use to listen to the show, please go give us a review. We're trying to get to 300 reviews. We have 204 right now. If we can get to 300, that would be awesome. Secondly, if you want to impact the show in the biggest way possible, go sign up for a VIP membership for $1 for your first month, $9.95 thereafter that. With that membership, you get inside access to an Oregon Duck community that's growing by the day. It's awesome group of guys, a group of women that talk Oregon athletics, follow Oregon recruiting. You've got insiders like Eric, Kevin, myself, our national team, our regional team. You get to read all of the content on the 24/7 Sports platform, not just our stuff on duckterritory.com, but you can go read everything that's VIP across the board. And you make sure that you are in the know ahead of time when news breaks and you're not caught off guard. All right, Eric, the men's side, a little bit different than the women's side. They too had home games. Over the weekend, they played the Bay Area schools, California, on New Year's Eve, a game in which Oregon won that one 82-69. And then Saturday night, a couple hours after the Fiesta Bowl from a football standpoint, the men were able to at least help change Duck fans' opinions of the day. It's not completely ruined by blowing out Stanford 73-56. The Ducks improve to 8-1 on the season, 8 straight wins for the Oregon men's basketball program that have now cracked the top 15 in the USA Today coaches poll.
All right, look, big picture here, just over the weekend, and then we'll jump into some of the games more in particular. Which second half was more impressive? Because Oregon, both games basically either trailed or led by a very small margin at half, right, and then big second halves. Which second half was more impressive, the Cal game or the Stanford game? And I asked that in part because, boy, they just figured out a way right now, it seems like, to just dominate down the stretch of these games. And I'll say these games were both like fairly competitive. And then it's boom, it's like in a flash, they go on a run.
Yeah, 15 lead changes in that Stanford one. I would say that the second half finish for Oregon in the Stanford game is probably what does it for me, because they're – in that first half, Stanford basically had the lead for almost the entire game, or in the entire period. Oregon would make a run to tie it, and then immediately Stanford would go down and score a bucket to go back up two or go up three. Oregon would get the lead. It'd be like, I'm just going to throw out a number, 27-26 off of two free throws. And then Stanford would immediately go down and hit a three. And now all of a sudden it's 29-27 Stanford. The Ducks are down by two again. It's like they would use all this energy to get the game tied or to take a small lead. And then Stanford would just have an answer for everything. And for Oregon, it was important in that first half where they never let the lead get too big. I think Stanford's largest lead in that first half was maybe 7 or 8 points. Oregon just didn't shoot the ball well in the first half. And it wasn't like they were taking poor shots. They shot 36% from the field, 21% on three-pointers. Dana Altman said after the game that he felt like going in, they were going to take a lot of threes because Stanford's style is a lot like North Carolina. Jared Haas, their head coach, played under Roy Williams, coached under Roy Williams. And he said, that's, you know, you pop in North Carolina, you pop in Stanford, you get the same thing from what a defensive standpoint. They all crash the paint. They don't want you to get to the lane, and they would much rather you shoot three pointers. And they ended up shooting 33, and they just weren't making them any shot really in the first half. 3 of 14 on threes, 12 of 33. And then about midway through that second half, LJ Figueroa shot a three-pointer, and I've never seen this before. From where he was, he shot a three-pointer, knew it was off, and he immediately raced down the lane. Stanford did not block him out. And by the time the ball hit the rim, it bounced up into the air. LJ Figueroa was jumping up to get it and slammed it home. It was almost like what you would do in like a dunk contest with no defense to, you know, impede you. It was impressive. And after that play, it was like an avalanche. Oregon at one point hit like 7 of 8 field goals being three-pointers over like a 6-minute stretch to pull away in that second half. And I looked at that and watched that game. And I threw it out on Twitter that game felt like maybe the number one team, Oregon, playing maybe the number two team in the league, Stanford. At least that night they were, because Stanford has a bunch of high level athletes. They've got an NBA draft pick in Zaire Williams. I think Oscar Da Silva is probably another NBA player as well. Really impressive performance by Oregon to come back and win in the fashion that they did, where you pop on the box score and it's like, whoa, they won by how much? They won by 17. And I honestly don't think Oregon played better than a C-plus game.
Yeah, it was a funny one to follow because you're right. Like, and then we should know, I just pulled it up there, that Figueroa basket, that dunk, ties the game at 41 with 12:30 to play. And Oregon just completely dominates the rest of the game, obviously outscores Stanford 32-15 from that point, and it's just over. But I just look at this team, like, it doesn't feel on paper like a team that should have that kind of just like big run ability, because like the three-point shooting has been kind of up and down at times this season. But it does feel like a team that can just kind of, like, I don't know if it's a mentality thing, and maybe you can speak to this, Matt, of like what has allowed them this weekend in both those games to turn what was a pretty close game in both of them into a double digit game at the end. I mean, like, is it just as simple as they have a lot of different guys who can beat you? Because it does feel like there's kind of what's developed here, and they're all veteran guys, and all of them are either junior college or transfers from other schools, but they've got this kind of foursome here with Chris Duarte, Eugene Amaruri. We should note Chris Duarte was a Pac-12 player of the week this week. LJ Figueroa, Eric Williams. Those four guys are these veterans that seem to be really, like, they just seem to play like above their heads almost a little bit at times. Like, what is it that allows this group to kind of pull away like that? Because again, you look at some of the stats this season, and it doesn't look like a team that necessarily should have that big run mentality or that big run possibility.
Yeah, I think this is the Pac-12's best team, and I don't think there's one in the conference that, call me a homer, but I don't think there's a school in the league right now outside of Oregon that's on their level. Their best lineup is when they play small. They go with four guys that are 6'6", Eugene Amaruri, Eric Williams, Chris Duarte, LJ Figueroa. And then they have either Amari Hardy, who's a 6'2" senior guard. Right now, Aaron Estrada, who's Estrada is like 6'5". And then Jalen Terry, who's out for COVID reasons, who's 6'. So basically they put out there four guys that can play all four different positions on the court. Defensively, they can switch almost everything. And all of these guys are really athletic. They're strong defenders and they're all long. And I think teams have a hard time for 40 minutes being able to handle the intensity that Oregon plays with on defense and then flip the script and have the ability to, you know, match up and rotate. And when they get switched off, you know, off a ball screen or something, to match with Oregon's, you know, athleticism on the other end. Cal was a game in which they had bigger players, but their bigger players were not even close to being the same athlete that Oregon's guys were.
Right.
And they weren't skilled like Oregon's guys were. So while they were bigger, they couldn't take advantage of the height because Oregon could switch off anything. They were strong enough to, you know, hold themselves in the paint consistently defensively. And then when Oregon had the ball, Cal's big guys had no answer in that game. And then in the Stanford game, Stanford had the athletes to hang. You know, they had bigger players and they were athletic enough to, you know, stay with Oregon's guys. But from a skill standpoint, they weren't even close to what Oregon had. You know, so it was just a matter of, hey, just wear them down because eventually they're going to start making mistakes. I didn't notice this until after the game was over. But against Stanford, Eugene Amarui, he had like 16 fouls drawn against Stanford players. I mean, that's insane.
Wow. He shot two free throws.
Yeah. And a lot of them were charges. Because a big guy trying to drive past Eugene or Amarui or post him up and get real physical because he's, you know, smaller than him. He just took a charge. And then a couple other times he got a bunch of fouls, you know, because teams just literally couldn't stay in front of him and they had to foul him. And it was impressive to watch. And, you know, I think this is what's going to make this team, like, yes, they don't fit the traditional style. They don't have a 6'11 Dante anymore that can defend the rim and back to the basket offensive type guy. But you look at this and think they just wear you down. They are in your face defensively the entire game. And they have the ability to play all over the court. I mean, but true positionless basketball. And it's just like to beat this team, I think you're going to need to be taller, bigger, faster, and equally as skilled, if not more skilled than Oregon's guys. Because if you don't have that combination, they will find the weakness in you and just exploit it time and time again. Because Stanford tried to go big on them. It didn't really work. It worked for a while. And then late in the game, Oregon caught fire. You know, eventually their three-pointers started falling and Stanford had no ability to keep up with how spread out Oregon was. And once they overextended themselves, allowed Oregon to get dunks and get the layups in the lane. Cal, they tried to go small and Oregon's guys just abused them after it was clear the big guys couldn't stick with Oregon's guys.
Talked about all of the kind of roster uncertainty on the women's side. The men actually have more. let's run through some of this and kind of what the latest we know here is, because I think what makes this really impressive is Oregon has won 8 straight games. They've won obviously all 3 conference games. They're atop the conference along with UCLA. You look at the standings, Arizona State also has 0 losses, but they've only played 1 game. But they've done this without any Will Richardson. They've done this with Anfali Dante now done for the year. You mentioned Jalen Terry. Out for a little bit with the COVID stuff. Frank Kepnang is somebody whose name, what's going on there? Like, when can this Oregon team really expect to get back to or get to a full strength in terms of numbers? Or do you think they're going to be kind of playing with this 7-8 man rotation for the majority of this season?
Yeah, let's start with the most easiest answer here. We know Anfali Dante's season is over.
Right.
So he will not be available moving forward for Oregon. The strangest thing of it all was he played a game almost in its entirety before he just was completely removed. He played an entire first half with a torn ACL and then in the second half tried to play again with it, had Eugene Amarui fall on his leg, and he then never returned, but asked to go back in. Out onto the court. He has yet to have surgery. Why? I don't know. Strange deal, but he moves around. Like I'm not hearing this. I'm not speculating. I'm just wondering, like, I know he's played with the torn ACL and he hasn't had surgery for a while. And this is like a 3-week injury now. I don't know. The only other explanation is maybe he's waiting 2 months, 3 months to see if he could play. I don't know. I mean, it's just weird. It's typically you get an ACL injury, you immediately start rehab. He's not done that. Now, knock on wood, this will happen. And next time we see him, you know, in Fall of Dante, he will have had surgery, but it's just a weird deal. He's out for the year. Frank Kapang, when does he get available? Dana Altman said his conditioning still needs to get better. They're starting to work him in. They're starting to get more comfortable with him in the rotations. He's starting to pick things up. He's not worked with the first team yet. I look at this and think he's probably not going to play this week at Colorado, at Utah. Might see him on the 14th or the 16th, two home games against Arizona State, Arizona. Most likely, in my eyes, I think they bring him out for the Oregon State game, January 23rd. It's a game in which Oregon should win in just blowout fashion. It's a one-game runoff for the week. Play him in that game for limited minutes. See what you got and go from there. Gives him a couple of weeks to continue to get ready for that game. I don't think I would be really shocked if he plays this week. I won't be as shocked, but a little shocked if he plays next week against the Arizona school. So I'm looking at this saying the Oregon State game in 3 weeks is probably when we see Frank Kapang. And look, he can help Oregon. He's 6'11". He's 240 pounds, really athletic dude. Probably not even close to being polished offensively as you would hope, but just from a pure fouls perspective, giving guys just a couple minutes breather each half and being able to maybe rebound the basketball is a win. And I caution Duck fans with this. Yes, he was a top 30 recruit, but also remember before the NCAA announced that this season guys were going to be able to keep their years of eligibility for next year, Oregon was planning on Frank coming into the program and redshirting. There was no plan in place for him playing in 2020, 2021 in the normal situation because they had Dante. They didn't feel like they needed to play him. They wanted to develop him a little bit. That just temper expectations. Like if he comes out and gives you two or three points a game and three or four rebounds a game, I think that's golden. Will Richardson's status, not playing this week. He's back with the team after spending Christmas break and an extended Christmas break at home. Dana Altman said that it just wasn't fair to him because he really couldn't do much. And because of COVID, and he's just sitting in his room. So they allowed him to go home ahead of Christmas for a couple of days, extra time with family. He's back now with the team. He's cleared protocol. His brace on his hand has been changed to something smaller. So he's getting progress. Dana Altman said 14th, 16th, kind of the best case scenario, which would be the Arizona schools. Again, I think we might see him in that game, in one of those games. Probably more likely we see him against Oregon State, or maybe even the last week in January when they play the UCLA, USC teams on the road. From there, it's now, okay, what can you do? What, you know, where can you develop? Dana Altman continues to say Luke Ware is a guy that they're continuing to try and bring along a little bit more in practice, develop him a little bit more, 6'9 guy, redshirt freshman forward, really athletic, but really raw from a skill standpoint. But, you know, Altman said, like, if we just need Luke to be able to give us 6 or 7 minutes a game and be happy about those 6 minutes and play really hard for those 6 minutes. Because guys need rests, and that's going to be what Luke Ware's role will be. That's a tongue twister this season. And then Aaron Estrada, it's kind of the same deal. Like, I don't know if they were necessarily counting on him to be a guy that was going to play 20 minutes every single game this year. But now that Jalen Terry is out with his injury, Will Richardson is, or with his health issue, Jalen Terry is out with his injury. Will Richardson's out with his health injury. So many point guards are hurt. Estrada has been forced into that role to play a little bit more, and they're going to have to get him to play probably a little bit more than they were anticipating going into the season. But I think from a best case scenario, Oregon probably has their full available roster of players in about 2 or 3 weeks.
And I think that's scary for the Pac-12, right? I mean, this is a team that's like hasn't looked, and it still is a bummer that UCLA game was postponed. And I don't think on the podcast have we talked basketball since that happened?
I don't think so. It's been.
I guess it's so old that we don't necessarily need to rehash it all. But I know that Matt went to the stadium thinking he was going to cover a basketball game, and then never covered the basketball game.
Yeah, it was like I get into the arena, I get to the parking garage, I get out of the parking garage, and I see a tweet from the University of Oregon student Duck TV account. It's where a bunch of students who are aspiring to be like newscasters and sports directors and on the TV side tweet out the game has been postponed due to a COVID reason. And I check social media. There's really nothing out there besides that. There's nothing from the team account, but all of the people that are working the game that I see every time I show up are exiting out of the arena like 25 minutes before the game starts. And it's like, it's not normal. It's difficult to figure out what's going on. And lo and behold, there was a ref that had tested positive for COVID-19. And because he had worked with the crew last night, the previous night at Oregon State, and that same crew was going to cover the game against UCLA and Oregon, all the refs were wiped out for contact tracing. There were no other refs in the area to bring in. And now we're up to a point where it's okay, well, when can this game get in? Because look, UCLA was picked to win the league. Oregon is probably now the overwhelming favorite to win the league. Chris Smith, their star player, is torn an ACL, unfortunately. And you know, we'll see what happens. But that was going to be a good litmus test of just how good this team is, how good both teams are. They match up very similar, bunch of loaded dudes in terms of talent. And now we wonder, when does it get played? Dana Altman's keeping the weeks where they don't play, where they play Oregon State, and that's it, open for potential makeup dates. The first chance that Oregon has a potential makeup game is in a couple weeks when they play Oregon State on Saturday the 23rd, but that doesn't fit with UCLA's schedule. More than likely, we're going to see this game played early March when both teams play right now tentatively just one game that week. A March 6th Saturday game. The Ducks are in Corvallis. UCLA is at home against USC. So it wouldn't surprise me if like Tuesday, maybe Wednesday, the Ducks and the Bruins play in early March at Matt Knight Arena.
Kind of an interesting upcoming schedule here. Let's talk about this here before we finish the men. Can Oregon finally win in Boulder? It's something they've never done. and they play there on Thursday, and it's a Colorado team which hasn't been fantastic thus far this season. I know they've got some talent back. McKinley Wright's really, really good, but that feels like maybe this is the year they finally do it. But I feel like we've said this for like 5 years and it's always gone the other way. And then they host after that. They play Utah on Sunday, of course, as part of the Mountain Road trip. And then they host the Arizona schools and then host Oregon State. And I feel like this 5-game stretch is really pivotal for the race from the Pac-12, because if Oregon can take care of business here and maybe they win 4 out of 5 games, like you said a second ago, they should be back to close to full strength as they can be all season after that. And that leads you right up to that big game with UCLA on January 28th. This 5-game stretch feels really key, Matt. You look at it kind of, we did this kind of on the women's side a second ago of like, and the women's is a little different because it's top 10 teams are facing and they haven't had those experiences yet. But like, I look at this stretch and think if Oregon can go 4-1, even 3-2, like I still think they're completely in the driver's seat for the Pac-12 just because of what they'll be after that when the whole, you know, when the rest of the team at least kind of gets back into shape. Is that your perspective, or kind of how do you perceive this 5-game stretch against the Colorado, Utah, Arizona State, and then Oregon State?
Look, if they can't win in Boulder, this is going to be a super hot take and partly in jest and joke. But if they can't beat Colorado this year with no fans,
that's true.
They're never going to win in Colorado ever. The Dana Altman has kind of even joked about it. It's like, damn it, we got to win sometime there. We've never done it before. And it's true. Oregon has never won in Boulder. And this is going to be a good game. two of the better teams in the conference. Colorado is actually higher in the net ranking than Oregon is right now. The Buffs have an experienced team. McKinley, right? The fourth, it is one of the best point guards in the country. It will be a really good test for Oregon. I think it might be like Colorado minus one, Oregon minus one. Like that's kind of where my feelings land in terms of betting odds, basically a coin flip. They should beat Utah. Utah is a solid team, but I don't think they have the athletes or the skill to hang with Oregon. Arizona State, we'll see if this game's even played. They're battling COVID issues. Last time I checked, they're on pause right now. And if they do get to play, it's been a while since they've played a game, since they've been able to practice. We'll see what happens. Like that could be a game where Oregon blows them out, and it's not really a true indication of how close these two teams are, because just the pause that ASU has had to take could really be a factor here. And then Arizona, I think they're good. I don't think they're elite. They've got a lot of young players, a lot of international players. Oregon should be able to handle them as well. Won't say blowout, but Oregon should win that game. And then Oregon State, they should blow the Beavers out. Like I look at this and think probably the most realistic 4-1 out of this next 5-game stretch. 3-2 is probably possible. It would be a little bit of a shock. 2-3 would be unacceptable, but kind of worst case scenario. Like you only win 2 out of these next 5. Utah and Oregon State, that's a missed golden opportunity. But I think there is a true legit possibility that this team goes out and it goes 5-0 and wins all 5 of these games. They will be favored against Utah. They will be favored against ASU, Arizona, and Oregon State. So you win those 4 and Colorado's a coin flip. If you can get that win against Colorado, that could, and then you go on and win the next 4, it really positions you as basically, the odds on favorite to win the league.
Yeah. And I think it's a telling stretch here for them. And, the league feels like, it comes and goes in waves. It seems like where the Pac-12 has a lot of national respect in terms of the rankings and high seeds in the NCAA tournament. This year feels like, unfair or not, Oregon's kind of carrying the banner for it because,
yep,
Arizona's not what they usually are. I think UCLA probably could have been if not for the Smith injury. Colorado is a veteran team, but they never are going to be kind of that sexy big name. Washington State's 8-1, but that's certainly a program that never gets anyone too excited. I look at this and think like, what's and in part because we just did this kind of similar exercise on the women's side of like, what's the best possible seed situation for the Oregon women? And I think it's hard to foresee a scenario where they really fall below like a 4 seed, maybe a 5 seed, even if they kind of struggle. I look at the men's side and these games are a little bit more impactful because if they struggle and lose to some of these teams, like I could see, like fair or not, this is a conference that like the conference champion might be a 5 or a 4 seed. Whereas on the women's side, the conference championship is going to be a 1 seed every season. They're going to have a couple other in the 2 line. Like, what do you you look at Oregon here? Like, what's the best case scenario? And what's the worst case, do you think, in terms of, I know we're way out here and we've got a ton of games to play, but like, do you look at this and think like there's a scenario where Oregon wins the conference and is like a 5 or a 6 seed or even a scenario where they struggle and they end up being kind of a fringe team on the bubble just because the conference isn't very good, or is that too much of is that too disrespectful to what the league is right now?
I get what you're saying, but I think it's probably too disrespectful to where the league is and probably too disrespectful for Oregon and how they're perceived from the national committee and from, everyone else around. You look at KenPom and the Pac-12 has a good amount of teams in that top 50. checking in, 44 is Stanford. That's one team. You have UCLA at 34. That's the second team. Arizona at 28. That's the third team. They're not eligible, though, for the NCAA tournament. Nonetheless, they're a top 30 team. That's the third team. USC is one spot ahead at 27. That's four. Pac-12 second or fifth team is Colorado at 22. And then the sixth team in the top 50 is Oregon. So while they don't have
the marquee
top
team,
10 team, right, or Oregon's on the cusp of top 15, their overall depth though is pretty good. And you go beyond the top 50 and just look at the top 80 and you find a couple more teams. Utah is at 65. Arizona State is at 57, just outside the top 80. Just outside the top 100. You also have, I just missed them. Where did they go? Regardless, you've got two more teams that are, in that top 80 that are solid teams as well. So there's going to be wins. There's not really going to be that opportunity for Oregon unless they go out. They have one game left they can schedule for non-con. And Dana Altman said that if they get to a point in the year where it looks like they're going to play a majority of their conference games, he will be willing to schedule a big, a big non-con game in the middle of the week of something. So if best case scenario comes out and maybe they do get a big non-con game in March or February, but right now their best win from a non-con perspective is Seton Hall. But you look at the opportunities that they have the rest of the way and, starting this week, number 22, Colorado, 65, Utah, 57, Arizona State, number 28, Arizona, 34 UCLA, 27 USC, and then they do it all over again. They play Arizona State, they play Arizona, they play Colorado, Utah, Stanford. All those teams are in the top 70 in the country. You've got an opportunity to rack up a whole bunch of like real solid wins. None that are just like, oh my God, this is amazing, huge win. It's a marquee win for any team in the country. But you've got a whole bunch of really solid games that are wins here. And I think if they're playing 20 conference games this season, the Pac-12, if Oregon was to go 17-3 in conference play and they finish the season 23-6, or they're playing 27 games, so it would be 22-4. Like, I look at this and think Oregon's probably going to be a 2 or a 3 seed. They probably don't have enough wins right now to position themselves as a number one seed. Now, if they were to go out and play a Gonzaga or a Baylor or another top 10-ish type team and win for that one last remaining non-con game, then they could maybe enter that discussion as a one seed if they only lose one or two games in conference play. If they go with 3 or 4 losses in conference play, they're probably going to be in that 2 to 4 range as a seed perspective. If they lose 6 or 7 games, they might fall to that 5 or 6 seed. But right now, I have a hard time seeing them being anywhere below 6 right now. And that's being very, worst case scenario. Probably can't get to number 1, but 2 is on the table still for sure.
All right, last one on my end here before we wrap up this basketball podcast. When everybody does come back, how different could the rotation look? And I ask that because does it feel like, I assume Will Richardson just, maybe not day one, but once he gets a little bit of season back in terms of getting some game reps, becomes one of your starting guards. How much can this rotation change, though? I know Kepnong probably doesn't factor into much of anything, and you've got a couple other guys that are Jalen Taylor is never going to start. But who moves out of the lineup? Is it as simple as Amari Hardy just steps out of the lineup as your point guard, and Will Richardson steps in, or could you see there being more to this rotation once everything kind of falls into place here in a couple weeks?
I think once Will Richardson gets back, it wouldn't surprise me maybe if they start Hardy for 1 or 2 games just to let Will kind of ease himself back in. I think Hardy hasn't been the scorer that you anticipate coming into the year, but you look at him from a point guard perspective in which he's playing a little bit out of position. He's not really
a true point guard. And that's what he's been forced to play because of the injury to Will Richardson. He's more of a guy that plays off the ball and then in short spurts can be your backup point guard. But the last few games, he's really come on strong as a true point guard. 7 assists against Stanford, 1 turnover. 5 assists against Cal, 2 turnovers. 5 assists against Portland, 0 turnovers. So he's got 17 assists to just 3 turnovers in his last 3 games. Really, really good stuff there from Hardy. So that's why I think they probably will ease Will Richardson into it for a little bit, but eventually Will move back into the lineup. Hardy will come out and be kind of like your sixth man, give you another guard to come off the bench. And then once Jalen Terry gets back into the mix, probably Aaron Estrada's minutes will get eaten into a little bit. Estrada right now is playing about 15 minutes a game. And that's kind of what Jalen Terry was playing before he had to be out for, while we don't technically know the reason, it's COVID. They're waiting on testing is what they originally said for COVID-19. But we haven't seen him on the bench. He's in Eugene. He's just not with the team. So Terry and Estrada will probably split that 15 or so minutes that each of them are playing with the other one out. And then after that, Frank Kapang maybe gets in and maybe Dana Altman goes instead of saying, hey, you know what? Like, I don't want to play Figueroa and Eugene Amarui and Eric Williams and Chris Duarte. I don't want to play them 32 minutes a game. Maybe I want to play these guys 28, 27 minutes a game. And that 12 minutes that you just paired away, or that 8 minutes that you just paired away, you give a couple of that to Frank Kapang, and maybe you give that, the rest of it to Estrada or to a Jalen Terry. But your primary rotation, once everyone gets healthy, will be Eugene Amarui, Chris Duarte, Eric Williams, LJ Figueroa, Will Richardson, Chandler Lawson, and Amari Hardy. Those 7 guys. And then you any smaller minutes that are available, the scraps that are left, it'll be up to Estrada, Jalen Terry, Luke Wuer, and Frank Kapang to battle over those minutes and decide, who gets what. It's going to do it for us here on the Odds and Audibles podcast, this Tuesday edition, basketball focused. And real quick, before we dive into more shows in the future, we want to update you on some changes to the podcast. The dates will still be the same as what we're currently doing, but we're going to be flipping kind of the topics, if you will. Mondays will be turning into, now that football is over, we typically recap the previous football game on Monday's show. Monday will now be recapping our Oregon basketball games from both the women and the men's side. Tuesday's show will be focused on some kind of football topic. Wednesday will continue to be the mailbag. And then Friday we'll also discuss football, other big news that's happened throughout the week. So keep that in mind as next week, the podcast will see a slight change to how we operate, but nonetheless, still a bunch of good stuff coming up here on the podcast. And until we talk to you tomorrow with the mailbag, thank you for listening to the Odds and Audibles podcast.
Talk to you later, folks.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and 3-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.